We wanna smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we'll hear excerpts of a recent speech by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. After his retirement from the agency, Ray helped found the organization Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Ray McGovern spoke in Santa Rosa, California on September 24th, and Project Censored sponsored the event and recorded it. Please stay with us. We're not commodities or cogs that turn to global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. Now let's turn to Ray McGovern's speech following his introduction by Peter Phillips.
Sonoma State University Sociology, Social Justice, and Activism Club. The Vets for Peace, of course, KBBF, KWTF, Guns and Butter, Move to Amend Sonoma County, the Peace and Justice Center of Sonoma County, Petaluma Progressives, Sonoma County ACLU, and Occupy Petaluma. So thank you for all that support and everyone being here. I'm very honored to introduce Ray McGovern as a man of conscience and a man of activism. Ray was a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. His duties included chairing the national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief. In 1990, McGovern received the CIA's Intelligence Commendation Award when he retired. Some years later, as the CIA was recognized for torturing people, he gave them their award back. In January of 2003, Race helped create Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war on Iraq. In October 13th, Mr. McGovern and three former winners of the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence traveled to Moscow and presented the Sam Adams Award to Edward Snowden. I'm very welcome to introduce Ray McGovern.
Let me try to set a framework around this evening in talking about human rights and the surveillance state and why it is we find ourselves in such a terrible position now in this country. I like to go back to right after World War II, when we became the sole superpower of the world. Okay, so it wasn't 1991 when the Soviet Union imploded. It was after World War II when the Soviet Union had just lost. How many people died in the Soviet Union during World War II? Yeah, 20 million at least. Most people say 25. 20 million civilians, okay, and 5 million Soviet soldiers. So if you put that in perspective and you say, well, now we emerged as the sole remaining superpower of the world, so we had to figure out how we're going to conduct ourselves. And the head of the State Department policy planning staff, a fellow by the name of George Kennan, who was really the author of the deterrence policy and deterring Soviet expansion, he came up with the first policy paper of the policy planning staff, and this is a portion of it. So you can see the dilemma here. We've got half of the world's wealth. What do we mean by the world's wealth? Anybody? Just shout it out. Oil, minerals, right? So natural resources. All right, we have 50% of that, but we're only 6.3% of the population. Bummer. So what do we have to do? Well, our real task is to maintain this position of disequilibrium and disparity, okay? Now, how are we going to do that? Well, one thing we know, we have to dispense with all this daydreaming and sentimentality. We can't deceive ourselves to think that we can afford the luxury of altruism. And we should stop talking about vague, unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far away when we will have to deal in straight power concepts. So, I'm thinking about my grandson Ronan. When he was 4 years old, I proctored a final exam in his nursery school. Actually, I just helped out the teacher, right? So after it was over, I said, "Miss So-and-so, this is really cute, these little guys, you know, but what do you hope to teach these people at that tender age?" I said, "Oh, that's simple, Mr. McGovern. Come sit down." So I sat down at a table. And she said, "Mr. McGovern, how many toys are on this table?" And I said, "5. And she said, "How many chairs are around the table?" I said, 9. She said, "That's what we teach them." So I said, "Explain me, please. Come again." She said, "We teach them that you have to share things. The antithesis of this." So clearly, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney didn't go to this nursery school. They probably never went to any nursery school because they never learned. We can't be pretending to keep more than our share. And it's coming to an end, folks. You know, it's coming to a very quick end. I'd like to sort of proceed now in the spirit of Project Censored and begin by citing my favorite little paragraph from Martin Luther King Jr.'s eloquent letter from the Birmingham City Jail. He said, "Like a boil that can never be healed so long as it's covered up, but must be opened to the natural medicines of air and light, so too deceit, injustice must be revealed with all the friction its revelation brings to the air of national opinion and the light of human conscience before it can be cured." That's what we're doing here. That's why I'm traveling around wherever they'll have me, just trying to spread some truth around. And of course, that's what Project Censored is centered on. Now, I'd like to fast forward to the NSA abuses, which really, you know, at the time that the surge in I almost said Vietnam, in Iraq was happening, we had the NSA, the National Security Agency, already suborned into violating our rights under the Fourth Amendment. Now, the Fourth Amendment has an incredible history. You might remember how the colonists were treated by British troops, and our founders were hell-bent and determined that would not happen to these new American citizens. And so they wrote, "The right of the people to be secure," okay, has to do with security, okay? "The right of the people to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures in their persons, their houses, their papers, and effects shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and clearly describing the places to be searched and the people or things to be seized." End of paragraph. One sentence, okay? Now, as you all know, before Iraq, the war in Iraq, we were told by Colin Powell and 6 months before 9/11 by Condoleezza Rice, who was then the assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, that Saddam Hussein had all manner of weapons of mass destruction. We didn't want the first real indicator of that to appear as a mushroom. You guys are good. Mushroom cloud. That was after 9/11 when they adduced these mushroom clouds. Before 9/11, Condoleezza Rice said, "Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. He is not even a threat to his immediate neighbors." She said that on the 29th of July, 2001, then 9/11. Now, you know, because you've heard it 100 times, complete the sentence, please. After 9/11, everything changed, right? So, whereas before 9/11, Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, after 9/11, weapons of mass destruction descended like manna from the heavens for a soft landing on the soil of Iraq, where God made the terrible mistake in putting our oil, okay? You can't get weapons of mass destruction in a month or a year or even 2 years. And you certainly can't get them without our observing them. So the intelligence before the Iraqi war was not a mistake, folks. Please don't let anybody tell you, especially George Bush and Dick Cheney, how sorry they are that the intelligence was a mistake. It was fraud. It was out-and-out fraud perpetrated by my former colleagues because the president wanted to make a war, and the unscrupulous director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, said, "Yes, sir. You want me to jump? How high to jump? I got a bunch of sycophants here, what I call malleable managers. They will cooperate, and that's why we got our war." So after 9/11, everything changed. And that wasn't the only thing that changed. Even before 9/11, does anyone know what was going on in Folsom Street down there in San Francisco, where AT&T and Verizon had their little switchboard? NSA was plugging in there, back door. They were getting our stuff even before 9/11. But 9/11, everything changed, and NSA's collections went on steroids. They collected everything they could, and the technology eventually made it possible for them to collect everything. I mean, the mind boggles. I couldn't believe it when I first heard. But all our telephone calls, all our emails, all our videos. And folks, don't let anybody tell you it's just the metadata. It's the content. Why else do they need these several football fields size storage places in places like Utah? You know what you can fit on a little thumb drive. Think about all that stuff. That's our stuff, okay? So what happened was James Risen learned about that. James Risen was a New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter. Incredible record. He's written books and everything else. So he learned from his sources that General Hayden, the head of NSA, had let himself be suborned into cooperating with this gross violation of the Fourth Amendment and of the what they call the First Commandment out there in NSA, which was, "Thou shalt not collect or eavesdrop on Americans without a court warrant." Okay? That was pretty sacred. Matter of fact, after the church hearings in the 70s, when NSA and the FBI were caught wiretapping to a fare-thee-well, the FISA law, 1978, said precisely that, thou shalt not collect on Americans without a court warrant. So Cheney called General Hayden, Air Force, three stars. "General Hayden, we know about that First Commandment out there in NSA, thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant. Well, forget about it." "I beg your pardon, sir?" "Forget about it. We're in a war. Terror, 9/11, 9/11, terrorists, and national security. Forget about it." Now, Hayden took the same oath that many of you out here and I took, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what did he do? He conveniently forgot that oath and decided to play ball. Okay? Now, you know the result of all that. And what you may not know is that they canned a system, a very sophisticated system of collection that protected the identities of American citizens because they kept them encrypted. They canned that system, which cost $330 million, and opted for a very sophisticated system built by SAIC for $3 billion, which never worked, which was never put in operation, but which was in being when 9/11 happened. When Tom Drake went after 9/11 and looked at the old system, they had not only the data on the switchboard in Yemen. Remember those two terrorists or hijackers that were in San Diego? Those were the two that supposedly drove the plane into the Pentagon. Well, the President of the United States got up 2 months ago, and in defending this blanket surveillance, which is clearly illegal and against our Constitution, he said, "You know, if we only had that dragnet, that blanket surveillance, we might have been able to find out the telephone number of those terrorists in San Diego. Now, since Ed Snowden has released so much information, the NSA principal senior officers who devised the sophisticated system that did work have felt free to speak out. And what they say is, and this is proven, we had not one, the president's talk about, well, not one conversation between San Diego and this safe house switchboard in Yemen. We had at least seven, because the head of the counterterrorism center had said that years before. And we had not only the metadata, we had the content. Oh, but did we have the numbers? Did we have the telephone number which we could have used? Ask Bill Binney, senior scientist, mathematician par excellence of NSA, 44 years in NSA service. He says, anybody know about a caller ID? Yeah, I hate to tell you this, but that's as simple as it was. They had the numbers. What happened? NSA, the way Tom Drake explains it, NSA is very jealous of the information. Information is power, right? And they didn't really think this terrorist threat was very serious, so they kept it in-house, did not share it with the FBI, did not share it with the CIA, did not share it with anybody. And Tom Drake is the guy that found out about it after the fact, when the Senate House had this joint committee to look into 9/11, what happened before, and General Hayden lied through his teeth, saying we didn't know anything about it. And Tom had to sit in his conference room at this big executive thing they had every morning, about 12 of them, and here, as Tom says, hear General Hayden chortle. I don't know, what does a chortle sound like? As CIA and FBI were put on the docket and accused by all manner of congressmen and senators of failing in their job, which they did, of course, but NSA escaped any of it because they kept it all secret. Now, fast forward to when James Risen's article, which the New York Times delayed publishing for, anybody know? Would you say a month or so? A year and a half. Anyhow, long story short, James Risen goes to them a year and a half later, December of 2005, and he says, it's going to be embarrassing for you, Mr. Sulzberger, because my book is in galley. I have a couple chapters on all this illegal surveillance, and people are going to ask, hey, doesn't James Risen write for the New York Times? I wonder why the New York Times didn't carry a story. See? So Sulzberger, what does he do? What do you do when something like that happens if you're the New York Times today? Who do you call? No, you call the White House to see if it's okay, if you can publish. Now, bear in mind, for those of you of younger age, the New York Times used to be an independent newspaper, okay? When they had evidence like this, they'd play the story, but now they ask the White House first. So Bush and Cheney invited them into the Oval Office and said, no, terrorism, 9-11, 9-11, terrorism, fear, fear, national security, terrorism, and did we mention 9-11? And Sulzberger said, come on, I held off for a year and a half. Now, I'm going to have to publish. He walks out, George Bush says, we don't agree. Well, 10 days later, it's published, right? All hell breaks loose. The government is grossly violating the Fourth Amendment and the First Commandment out there at NSA, and the FISA law that was put in expressly to prevent this kind of thing. And who is tapped to explain the whole thing? General Michael Hayden, Air Force General, four stars now. He got four stars for good behavior. He got promoted. Yeah, well, he had a four-star, and they needed somebody to run the CIA. And so for services performed, he became nominated to be head of the CIA. Well, who's National Intelligence Director? That was a year and a half ago. Who's the National Intelligence Director now? Clapper, yeah. There you have the guy who's still the National Intelligence. What's the teaching point there? Yeah, so Hayden is, you know, he's a big CNN commentator now and Fox News commentator on all this intelligence stuff. So he's still going strong. Clapper is still in. And John Brennan, the head of the CIA, what about him? He hacked into the Senate Intelligence Committee computers, and Dianne Feinstein said, that was very bad to do that. That was very bad. And we have this five-year study, and it shows who did the torture and stuff. And now John Brennan is sanitizing it and inviting George Tenet and Michael Hayden and other intelligence officials to help him redact the names and so forth. And he gave that to the president, and the president gave it back to me. And Dianne Feinstein said, oh, it doesn't make any sense now without the nouns in these sentences. And so I gave it back to the president, and the president gave it back to John Brennan. And John Brennan used to be at the top of my dance card. But if he's still doing these things, what a phony. What a phony from the word go. So there used to be this sort of pas de deux with Brennan and Dianne Feinstein. Now it's a mélange à trois. You know, it's Obama saying, "Oh, here they you can release this." And she said, "No, I can't really go back there." I mean, who do they take us for? A bunch of fools? Now, how many of you know that your senator Dianne Feinstein has the power under the law to release that report now? Okay. Remember I talked about the 70s? When they did the FISA law and other laws to prevent such abuses, they realized that there would become times when the administration would resist letting the American people know what was going on. They would say, national security, secret, 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 and you can't release it. And so they put a provision in the law saying the Senate Intelligence Committee can get the whole Senate to approve the release of these reports. Now, it has to be a majority vote, but she could do that tomorrow. And she could redact whatever really needs to be redacted, but she could put it out tomorrow or this evening or the day after tomorrow. Now, why doesn't she? Got any ideas? Well, besides all the corruption, besides what it might indicate about her lack of discharging her duties, she's waiting for the election. What might happen in the election? Senate goes to the Republicans. Dianne is off the hook. And she could say, you know, I really tried. I pleaded with John Brennan and the president. They wouldn't release this. And now you don't have any names in these sentences, but it was not my fault, you know? Give me a break. What a fraud. You know, you guys should be occupying her office and making sure that she does her duty, because otherwise she's not going to do it. Why is she afraid? Well, NSA has lots of information on people, including Dianne Feinstein and that husband of hers who got real rich real quick. I don't know exactly how, but NSA knows. So blackmail is a major part of this whole operation. Now, I would just want to finish here because I've been talking too long and we want to have lots of questions. And what I'd say is that there's this excuse about, you know, well, I'm purer than Caesar's wife. I don't care if my emails or my telephone calls are being, I mean, you know, I've got nothing to hide. Well, Ed Snowden was watching James Clapper when he lied. And that's important. I forgot to mention that. That was then that he had already prepared, you know, he told me when I saw him 2 weeks ago in Moscow, he said, Ray, I looked around at my colleagues there in Honolulu and almost all of them had families and mortgages. And so I thought, I looked in the mirror and I said, you know, somebody's got to do this. Looks like you're elected, Ed, because I had the least to put in jeopardy. And that's why he did it, you know. So what I'm saying here, just to bring back my train of thought, is that that these kinds of revelations have enabled people like Bill Binney and the other people who quit right after 9/11 because they saw the indignities and saw these things. One of the things that Ed Snowden said, you know, after he got out into Hong Kong, was he exposed that, you know, that everybody was being collected on. And that's when you got this, well, I have nothing to hide. So they selected Wolfgang Schmidt, real name, okay? East German Stasi guy, senior executive. Now, Stasi, that's the East German police. About one out of eight East Germans worked for the East German secret police. Has anyone seen the lives of others? Ah, okay. Das Leben der anderen. It's on the web. The lives of others. Anyhow, it talks about how the secret police monitored people who were not involved in any crimes. Artists who people say, oh, he's a dissident because he, you know. So what they asked Wolfgang Schmidt, alumnus from the Stasi, was, Wolfgang, what do you think about people who say they have nothing to hide and so the government can't use this collection against them? Schmidt, what I say is these people are incredibly naive. This is why the government collects this secret information. And the only way to prevent it from being used against you is to prevent it from being collected in the first place. That's it. You don't get to decide how that information is used. They took Tom Drake's papers out of his private office in his home, and they retroactively stamped secret on some of the ones that weren't ever secret. These are the Department of Justice lawyers. And after 4 years of persecution, prosecution, the judge in Maryland, the federal judge, looked at those nine Justice Department lawyers and said, don't you ever dare bring a case like this to me in my court. A case based on such spacey, such inadequate, such forged information. All 10 felony charges dismissed. Get out of here. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that Tom Drake was put through 4 years of hell. He was made bankrupt. It was a public defender that in the end, and Jesselyn Radick, that helped him, you know, fight the system. So he was exonerated, but he's broke. He was making $160,000 as a top government official and worth every cent of it, given his technological expertise. Where is he working now? Anybody know? An Apple store. He's a wizard, you know. So what am I saying? Well, maybe this would speak to you. When we walked into that room where Ed Snowden was waiting for us on October 9 of last year, Colleen Rowley from the FBI, Jesselyn Radick from the Department of Justice, and Tom Drake, I was the first one in, and Ed knew we were coming. He hadn't met any of us, but he knew who I was. He said, hello, Ray. And then his eyes fixated on Tom Drake. And I could see what he was thinking. Here's the guy that went through 4 years of hell just so that I could learn how I could achieve my mission of letting Americans know what was going on and still have some reasonable prospect to be still alive and safe. And then I looked at Tom Drake, and he's looking at Snowden, and I've confirmed with Tom what he was thinking. He said, you know, I never thought anything good could come out of those 4 years, but this is good. Oh, God, it's such a poignant moment. We spent about 5-6 hours with him, and about 1:15, I said, hey, Ed, it's okay? You okay? He said, oh, yeah. So we got back to our hotel in Moscow about 1:45 the next morning. And when I recently saw him, he's in good spirits. He, of course, would like to come back to this country, but I think he has a reasonable expectation that just like Dan Ellsberg, he'll no longer be called a traitor. He'll be accepted as the patriot that he is. Don't let anybody call him a hero, you know? Heroes, you know, you put them on a pedestal and then you say, well, that's a hero. I couldn't possibly do anything like that, you know? That's called pedestalizing, okay? It gets you off the hook. No, he's a patriot because he took the Constitution of the United States, which I always carry around with me in my pocket in case I see Rumsfeld. You know, he took it seriously and acted on it. So, two more very small points. One of the worst abuses of this Dragnet collection is something called parallel construction. Anybody know what that is? Okay, You collect the information illegally, unconstitutionally, and you can't do anything really with it, except you can tell the sheriff. You can say, hey, sheriff, if you go down to Sunset and Vine here, 8 o'clock tonight, you can have a really big drug bust. And the sheriff says, oh, thanks a lot. And guess what? There's a big drug bust. And how did the sheriff know about it? From this illegally, unconstitutionally collected, which won't stand up in court, so they have to do a parallel construction as to how they learned about this guy being at this corner at that time, you know? I mean, talk about perverting the justice system. And the lawyers, that's a Freudian slip, the liars and lawyers. And the last thing I'll just say on this is that, have you heard about Unit 8200? Yeah, okay. That's the Israeli unit that's sort of like the NSA, intercepts messages and all that kind of stuff. Now, one of the revelations coming out of Ed Snowden is that we shared all this information on you and me, unredacted, unminimized, as they say, names and everything else with the Israeli service. So those of us who were trying to get to Gaza and the U.S. boat to Gaza 3 years ago, all our communications with everybody was being monitored by NSA. The people that we were trying to reach in Gaza, you know, they were being monitored. And finally, these monitors in Unit 8200 of the Israeli Secret Service finally said, you know, this is too much. We have a conscience, too. This is part of how they oppress and how they find out any Palestinian who says a word one against the Israeli government, and they wrap him up and throw him in prison or whatever. So they have made a public statement saying, we're not going to do that anymore. Now, we've tried to get in contact with them, but, you know, they're not easily contacted.
Again, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Here's more Ray McGovern from the recent talk he gave in Northern California.
Anybody heard about Albrecht Haushofer? Good, I can tell you about him. He was a geolog. He was a geologist at the University of Berlin, and he had tenure. Now, some of you know what tenure is, right? Pretty precious commodity, especially these days. And how did he get tenure? Because he kept his mouth shut. And as he watched his Jewish friends and others being wrapped up, okay, and sent off to Auschwitz and other places, he decided to speak out against this. He gathered quite an influential gathering around him, and of course the SS wrapped them up and put him in another prison in Berlin. The SS was very, very meticulous, and they wouldn't shoot you or hang you, those were the two methods they chose, without you signing a confession. Very, you know, very Germanic. So Haushofer said, get lost, I'm not going to sign a confession. What did I do? And so they shot him anyway. Now, as they picked him up off the floor, out of his pocket fell this little zettel, little piece of, anybody have German here? Yeah, okay. Little zettel, little piece of paper. And it was his confession, written in the form of a sonnet. It's not very long. Let me read it to you. Schuld. Guilt, right? The topic was Schuld. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Früher. Earlier. I should have earlier recognized my duty. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. I should have more sharply called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my verdict far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, and he did end up warning. Aber nicht genug. Enough. Und klar. Clear, claro, klar. There's no comparative in German for klar, okay? So, ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar, und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today I recognize what I was guilty of. So there is such a thing as too late. What Haushofer is saying is that that's what I was guilty of, waiting until too late. It may be time for some of us to put our bodies into the action. I learned when Hillary Clinton had her goons or GW University goons beat me up real bad simply for turning my back on her while she was speaking. I learned one thing. I learned that Americans don't like old people to get beat up, okay? Now, young people, they got it coming to them. Yeah, they got their neck. But old people, my friends in Veterans for Peace played it real big. They said, well, you know, not only is he 71 years old, for God's sake, but he's a cancer survivor, which I was just recently. And well, what happened? Hillary Clinton got hundreds of thousands of emails, telephone calls. Why? Because Americans don't like old people to get beat up. Now, I see some people out here who are almost as old as I am. And what I want to say is that you've got a huge advantage over the younger people, okay? They can dismiss the younger people, you know. But people like us, it's not so much they take us more seriously, it's just that they don't like old people to get beat up. So this huge advantage, I would sincerely suggest you put it into play, because there is such a thing as too late. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks very much.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We've been listening to a speech by retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, spoke in Santa Rosa, California on September 24th. We have one more clip we'd like to share with you today, the question and answer period from that evening, and here it is.
Go ahead.
Do you think times might have changed since Daniel Ellsberg and after the way Chelsea Manning been treated? Do you think Edward Snowden has any chance in the world except for his own high integrity?
Yeah, I do. Because I remember when Dan did his thing, okay? He was called a traitor, coward, you know, all the things that you saw Mike Rogers accuse not only Assange, but Bradley Manning of Chelsea Manning. So, yeah, things change. They can change pretty quickly. And you know, it's hard to reassure Ed that this is going to happen soon. But he's reasonably, you know, he's able to work. He's helped people, the legislators, not only in our country, but in the Bundestag, you know, try to prevent this kind of stuff. So he's gainfully employed. And I guess the supreme irony is that, as you probably know, but not many Americans know, that his choice was not to end up in Russia, right? That was because John Kerry, with his pastel tie, said, you have no more passport, you're stateless. Now, Mr. Putin, you must give him back to us, because I know we have no extradition treaty between our two countries, but you must give him back. And my own hunch is that Putin, sitting around a table with his advisors, he said, who is this guy? I must. Give him a year's worth of amnesty, because the international law required it anyway. So anyhow, the point being this. Ed Snowden, who freely admitted when he was in Hong Kong that they're going to come get me, chances are better than even. The CIA station's right down the road here. And indeed, they were close to getting him. He didn't expect to be in the one place on the face of the globe where no drone is going to send a Hellfire missile at him. And no SEAL Team 6 is going to come in and shoot him in the head like they shot Osama bin Laden. I mean, that's big. That's a hell of a thing to say about our country, but he's safe for a while. And I think he has hope that things will turn out okay. The other thing I was, he said, Ray, there's something really good going to happen next month. And I said, what's that? He said, we're releasing Laura Poitras' documentary on how I got out of Hong Kong. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, you won't believe it, Ray. Laura kept her camera on during this whole time, you know? And as the Chinese authorities and the correspondents found where I was, well, when you see the disguise that I slipped out in, you'll realize that this wasn't pre-planned, Ray. And how we got by all those people and onto that plane, well, come see the movie. I think it's called Citizen Four, after one of the code words they use, and it's in the theaters next month. By all means, go and see it, documentary, and you'll see how Ed Snowden escaped. And when I was with Julian Assange, I'll just mention this, I said, Julian, and this was 4 weeks ago in London, I said, Julian, I admire a lot of things what you did, but none better than stepping forward and rescuing Ed Snowden. Visualize the picture. Here, Ed gives up all these, whatever they were, thumb drives or whatever, and Laura Poitras, after she's filmed everything, and especially Glenn Greenwald, they said, thanks so much. Glenn is out of there, right? He's a reporter. He's not a social worker, right? And so Ed is left pretty much alone. What happens? Julian Assange cares enough, and he has enough contacts in enough places that he fingered Sarah Harrison, who is in Australia. He said, Sarah, get yourself to Hong Kong as soon as you can. Get this guy a ticket to Moscow. Get him out of there. And that's what happened. And so when I said, you know, Julian, that was really something, he smiled, you know, and he said, well, you know, yeah, the most powerful country in the world, the most powerful security services in the world, and we got him out, you know. And, you know, I said, yes! It's okay. It's okay to be that kind of celebratory and something like that. So these guys are the real deal, and I'm just really, really pleased that I've fallen into their company, because I remember my Irish grandmother saying to me several times, like 100 times, Raymond, show me your company, and I'll tell you who you are. I look around at these folks and say, well, Grandma, is this okay? And she says, yeah, you bet.
Are you familiar with the book Crossing the Rubicon by Michael Rupert, published in 2004?
I've met Michael, and I know about the book, but I haven't read it.
Okay, well, because I'd strongly recommend it. I mean, he talks about, in detail, carnivore software as well as other softwares.
Carnivore?
Carnivore, yeah, which I believe that's the software that he says was stolen by the CIA or the intelligence services. It ended up in the hands of the NSA, being the one that they used for surveillance. It was stolen from a private contractor who developed it originally. And another software to track stock market transactions. Mm-hmm. He ties together the war in Iraq, the peak yeah. oil, as well as the surveillance state and the war on terror in a way that I think few others have done. Anyway, I would highly recommend it, and I believe he speaks to a lot of what has now been proven by Snowden and Assange. And,
right. I admire Rupert. I was really sorry to hear that he died.
Yeah, he passed. Yeah.
Okay, I'll read the book.
I'm glad you mentioned Julian Assange. I was going to ask you about how he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I wanted to, and I'm going to throw this all out at once, and then you can answer. And I really appreciated seeing the photo from Democracy Now, actually, after that October 9th visit to Moscow last year of you and Jeslyn Radak and Tom Drake and all those folks. We had it up on our wall at our Peace and Justice Center event the next month. And I wanted to know how you were safely able to go in and see. And I don't want to know any of the tricks. I don't want you to say it out loud. But I'm just concerned about your going in to see Snowden. Okay. Maybe it doesn't matter. But I'm imagining you're followed. I mean, I don't know how you all got there more than once.
Those are really good questions. Now, let me fast backward to 1972 when I served in the Soviet Union, okay, part of the embassy. And there was somebody, at least three people, following me everywhere I went. And when they fell asleep at night, they'd call me on the telephone 3 o'clock in the morning to make sure I was still there, you know. That's how intrusive the surveillance was. This time, October of last year, I'm still worried about surveillance. But who am I worried about? Who am I worried about? The KGB or the Secret Service. The Russians knew we were coming, that we had arranged it with them. I was worried about employees of the U.S. Embassy trying to tail us so they could find out where Julian Assange is. Now, that's the height of irony in my view. Now, your question about how Julian is, he's about as okay as you can be not having seen the sun in 2 years, you know. The sun doesn't come into that window that he has. And he's still able to do all manner of things with his encrypted communications and so forth. He's also released more stuff. But, you know, clearly he'd like to be out of there. You know, only Cardinal Mincenti in Budapest stayed longer in that kind of embassy situation. Remember him during the Cold War? Well, not many of you are old enough to remember him, but he was in there for like 17 years or something like that, USMB in Budapest embassy. So the other thing you asked was, let's see if I can remember. Oh, yeah, how do we arrange it? Anybody know? WikiLeaks. Sarah Harrison, to her great credit, stayed with Ed Snowden in Sheremetyevo Airport in the transit lounge, which was, you know, extraterritorial company until he was given Assange. And then she stayed with him, to her credit, for I think about 2 more months, just so that she could attest to the fact that the Russians were not applying enhanced interrogation techniques to Ed Snowden and he wasn't being a spy for the Russians. Now, that's a big thing. And so what happened was, she was still there, and we went, that is we, Colleen Rowley from the FBI, Tom Drake from NSA, and Jesselyn Radick from the Justice Department, now a lawyer helping whistleblowers, we all went to Amsterdam to a hacker conference at the end of July of last year. Now, I say hacker conference. These are much more respectable people than just hackers. A lot of them are in their 30s now, right? They're getting old, and a lot of them have children. A lot of them have very high-paying jobs in Dutch security services or German security service or people who need high-tech people. So what happened? Well, we gave a spy panel at the end of this thing. There were 5 of us, including Annie Machon from MI5. And in the course of that, I told them that we had just awarded Edward Snowden the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. And they said, oh, that's great. Oh, they thought, what, you know, they feel really strongly about the freedom of the Internet and so forth. And then I said, now, our practice is to award this, make this award in person. And we've always been able to do this so far. But we don't know how we're going to get to Moscow. We thought we might be able to go now while he's still in Sheremetyevo and do it there. But anyhow, we don't know how we're going to get there. Guess what? The organizers on the spot said, we can help you. They sent baskets around and they collected enough money to crowdsource our travel, all 4 of us, back and forth from the U.S. to Moscow and back, and a nice hotel of the kind that I very seldom stay in anywhere, much less in Moscow. So isn't that neat? Crowdsourcing from people who just felt really strongly about what Ed Snowden had done and the fact that we had offered him that that award. A previous awardee was Julian Assange. And our most recent awardee, well, not most recent, the one we awarded in February was Chelsea Manning. We couldn't award her that award until she was convicted because you can't award somebody for something that is still not proven to be guilty, right? So, and guess what? We just picked the nominee for this year. It's Bill Binney, the senior executive from NSA, who's an incredible guy and has quite a story to tell. He's testified all over Europe and stuff. So, long answer short, WikiLeaks rose to the occasion again between Julian Assange, safe communications with Sarah Harrison in Moscow, and Tom Drake knows something about safe communications, too. We waited in Amsterdam 4 days to get in there in early August of last year. Everybody was on vacation. They couldn't get the proper security clearances, so we went home. And then in October, when our calendars were free, all 4 of us, then we were able to go in there. And it was the WikiLeaks people, Sarah Harrison in particular, who worked with the Russian authorities and worked with whoever else there was. She's got private security now and enabled us to do it. Anyone can visit Ed Snowden, and that's one reason why I did it. Not only do we consider ourselves friends now, but I needed to make the point that, yeah, he's pretty free. And if, you know, if he knows you or there's a good reason for him to meet with you, you can arrange it. Again, I did this again through Sarah Harrison, and she is one of those gutsy women that I talked about before, a real deal.
Thank you, Mr. McGovern. Yesterday, there were 128 bombing raids on Syria, including Aleppo. Supposedly, these were against ISIS and ISIL. There were also many bombing raids against northern Iraq. Barack Obama was at the United Nations yesterday proclaiming that this war will widen and there will be more war in the Middle East. Mr. Putin says this is illegal. Do you feel that the target in Syria is Assad? And just incidentally, it's the Jewish New Year's today, so I thought that might be a gift to Bibi Netanyahu.
What's happening? Well, we're not against Assad anymore. No, we're against ISIL. And so we're collaborating with Assad. And my colleague and my editor, Robert Perry, consortiumnews.com, from his own sources, found out and reported 5 days ago that they made a deal, the U.S. and Damascus, we're going to bomb your enemy, ISIL. Please don't shoot us down. We're friendly folks now. And so did any U.S. planes get shot down when we started bombing? No. I wonder why. The deal was made. So Assad's got to go, but not right now. Right now we're going to fight against these other guys that are better than Assad. And you can imagine how Assad's looking at this. You start bombing Syria for these guys, it's just a matter of time before you start bombing me too. So the thing is crazy. We've been there, we've tried that, and the only practical effect of all this stuff is to build more and more jihadis, more and more people coming in and making the recruiting lines in front of Al-Qaeda and ISIL recruiting stations longer and longer. It makes you wonder, cui bono? Who's profiting from all this? The arms dealers? The arms makers? We sell Iraq $3 billion worth of arms. We train them up, like Petraeus said. They're well-trained and they're ready to do battle. And then as soon as ISIL comes up, they run away. Four divisions. They run away south. What do they do with their heavy tanks and stuff? They leave them there. Who's going to get them? ISIL. What do? We bomb our own equipment. We kill all those tanks and all that kind of stuff because we can make more of them and we can sell more of them around it. I mean, is this a great country or what? It's crazy. So, you know, this is awful because the guys that are going to bear the brunt of this are the volunteer army, so-called, the poverty draft. And that's unconscionable. And if we're not out in the street, if we're not in Dianne Feinstein's office protesting this, then, you know, there's something lacking in our courage because it's getting to be too late.
The topic that we seem never be able to be discussing, and it's so convenient that Gaza has been knocked off the news of today. But back in the 80s, the Zionist movement had this game plan. I believe it's pronounced ODED, O-D-E-D, Yon plan, Y-I-N-O-N. Which basically talks about the greater Israel. And Wesley Clark discussed that, I guess, during the Bush-Cheney thing about taking out these five countries, dividing them all up. Do you believe that program is now in full force?
Well, what I've observed is that the so-called neocons, who are really running our foreign policy, their definition, in my view, are people who have real difficulty distinguishing between what they perceive to be the strategic aims and objectives of Israel on the one hand and those of the United States on the other. Now, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, okay? I don't dispute that, but I don't think they should be running U.S. foreign policy, and they have been. General Scowcroft, who is National Security Advisor to the first George Bush and then, Gerald Ford and then George Bush, he said gratuitously to the Financial Times, no left-wing rag, the Financial Times, he said when he was still head of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, he said two things. Benjamin Netanyahu has George W. Bush mesmerized. He's got him wrapped around his little finger. Now, for those of you who haven't heard about that, hello, you know. You don't hear about things like that. But why would Scowcroft, an incredibly careful person, go to the Financial Times and say that, get cashiered from his position as head of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, be told stay away from the White House doorstep? Why would he do that? Because he wanted us to know how closely, how much George Bush was a tool of Netanyahu and before him the other guys. And, you know, that shouldn't be. And when you look at what, you know, when people say, well, why they hate us? Well, John Brennan says, well, when they come out of the womb, the first thing they say is, and then they say, I hate America, I hate America, I hate America. In other words, they're hardwired to hate us at birth, you know, these Arabs and Islamists, you know. Hello. He said the equivalent of that when Helen Thomas said, why did they do this, okay? Now, why they do it is partly because there's no daylight between U.S. and Israeli behavior. And everyone in the Middle East knows that the Israelis could not possibly do the things they do, like kill 3,000 Gazans, you know, without the full support of the United States, and that our Congress is a tool of Israel, and that our president has no backbone. He knows what's going on, and so does John Kerry. And all these pastel ties that John Kerry wears, including the light blue one, can't cover up the fact that, you know, when he says to Netanyahu, please, please, please don't build any more settlements in the West Bank, because that's, you know, and Netanyahu goes like this, you know, and Harry says, oh, okay, sorry I mentioned it.
Last question.
Thank you, Ray. I really appreciate your humanity and your courage and your service to our country and the democracy that we have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to, as you know, the CIA was created in 1947, part of the National Security Act, which occurred within a couple of months after the Roswell UFO crashes. Now, I'm wondering what the CIA, what has been hiding from the American public about these alien visitors.
Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't know. But if anyone knows, it would be the other CIA, the operations people, not the analysis things. So go ask those operatives. They're tired of torturing people now. Ask them about this.
Okay, I think we're going to have to call it there. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you so much.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We've been listening to a speech by retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, spoke in Santa Rosa, California on September 24th. That does it for the Project Censored Show today. Thanks to our wonderful producer, Anthony Fest, engineer Erica Bridgman at the controls. Thank you, the listeners. The Project Censored Show is heard on nearly 20 radio stations now around the country. An archive of previous programs can be found at projectcensored.org. Please like us on Facebook, and please tune in next week. Thanks, too, to Junkyard Empire for our theme, We Want.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers in.